Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm joined now by Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hello, Joe Devine.
Hello. Seb and I were delighted today to be joined by Andy Townsend, who's here to talk to us about the new feature-length documentary Finding Jack Charlton, which is released transactionally, i.e. on the internet, on the 23rd of November, I believe, which was yesterday when you're listening to this. The first thing to say is that it's amazing, and I'm not, you know, it's
genuinely
so good.
Amazing. It's genuinely brilliant. Yeah,
I watched it this morning, and then I wept for about 20 minutes.
And then you're not an emotional man, really. You're not really enthusiastic about anything. I mean, you're not Alex, but you're sure. Still, you're towards
well, you know,
the
films.
End
but of, to put it this way, no. It's not like a dog dies in this film, and I still cried. So it's a wonderful film. It's a fantastic portrait of Jack, or Jackie, or Jack Charlton, or however you'd like to refer to him, when he was a manager of the Ireland team, of the Republic of Ireland. And it follows the trials and tribulations of the team. It follows his relationships with the players. Obviously, it followed, you know, in more recent years, his struggles with dementia as well. And of course, Jack Charlton has passed away before the film has even been released. So there's that to contend with too. But it's just fucking wonderful, I think. So this is before we even speak to Andy, but like, just definitely watch it, and it will be, you know, even if you don't care about, if you don't know anything about the history of football, you don't care about Ireland, you don't know any of the players. Let's say you're a young person, you don't know who Andy Townsend is. Watch the film. It's amazing. Seb, do you want to say anything about this interview?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Watch the film, but listen to our interview with Andy afterwards, because he talks very vividly about Jack, about his footballing memories, under him, but also about the person. And I think those are some of my favorite moments during the both the interview and actually the film, because I think it's just the most, it's very loving human portrait. It deals with a lot of complicated stuff very well, so the troubles in Ireland, but also Jack's relationship with his brother, obviously, so Bobby Charlton. Some of those moments are very moving too. I can't recommend it highly enough, and I really do mean that. It's a fabulous documentary.
Yeah, co-directed by Gabriel Clark and Pete Thomas. Fantastic job, people. Everyone, well done. You know, round of applause all around for participation in the film. Anyway, we've probably said enough, glowingly about it, but enjoy today's interview. Subscribe to The Athletic, of course, which all of the things I said about the film also apply to that. Oh, it's good.
That's nicely done.
Thank you. You can visit theathletic.com/TIFO, where you can find the I have no idea, because we're recording this very far in, not that far, but further than normal in the future than we would be in the past. I don't know. The tenses have confused me. I don't know where I am in the world, but there'll be some kind of special offer, which will be tantalizing for you to enjoy by visiting theathletic.com/TIFO. Right, anyway, I will now leave you in the exceptionally cool hands and the wonderfully warm embrace of Mr. Andy Townsend.
Andy, do you remember the first time you met Jack Charlton?
Yes, I do. It was around 1988, Norwich, we were enjoying a very strong season at that time. We were actually competing for the title with Liverpool in 1988, and I was obviously aware that of my Irish heritage. I was aware that I could play for Ireland, and so through Tony Cascarino, he had kind of recommended me to Big Jack, who had then sent Morris Setters and one or two to come and watch a few matches. And then he came to watch me himself at Millwall. So we played Millwall in a televised game. And it finished 3-2 to us guys. Robert Fleck scored a last minute cracker to win the game. And then after the game, I saw Jack and he said, look, he said, so you'd like to come and play for us? And I said, yeah. He said, well, look, he said, abide by the rules, do as you're told. He said, and I think you'll love it. And so that was literally it. It was a shake of the hands. It was no more than that at that stage. And, you know, he said, and it was very, very short and sweet. And then after that, I suppose the rest took care of itself.
Do you have any, I mean, you say you're aware of your Irish heritage. Did you have any trepidation about playing for Ireland at that particular point in history, given the situation in the country in between the Republic and Northern Ireland?
Yes, I did. I did have, I'd be a liar if I said I didn't have concerns. In fact, I got mail from obviously English football supporters that weren't particularly flattering, weren't the sort of stuff that you'd want to read. In fact, I remember one in particular, you know, why don't you get one of those letters every now and again? And their letters, they're like fan mail that are sent to the club, you know. And so in amongst sign this picture, sign that picture, nice to da da da, thank you very much, whatever. All of a sudden you get one that's like 2 or 3 pages long and you think, aye, here we go, you know. And sure enough, it's from somebody who's sort of reading me the riot act, et cetera, et cetera. And I wouldn't say it was anything I was losing sleep over, but they can be a bit unsettling. The biggest trepidation I had wasn't worrying about what English supporters would say about me. It was more about wanting to make sure that I would be accepted by the Irish fans and making sure that I wouldn't be letting anybody down, wouldn't be, because you're an easy target. When you put yourself in that sort of scenario, you can be an easy target on both sides of the fence if your performances aren't good. People would obviously have just said, mercenary, just wants to play international football, wants to pick up a few quid extra, da da da, all the usual nonsense that people trot out. So I was very conscious of that and of making sure that not only did I get in the squads, I got in the team, and when I got in the team, I wanted to make sure I played my part, you know.
How do you think he dealt with, I mean, in the first instance, when he was appointed in 86, obviously the film does a really good job of colouring the picture in Ireland and giving both sides of the response to his appointment. There's also some footage from a pretty notorious press conference that he held on his, you know, given after his appointment. What was it about him personally that allowed him to, over time, become an honorary Irishman, yes, but also to be accepted, you know, and to be able to get on with his job? What was it about him personally that allowed that to happen or quickened the speed of that?
He wasn't a complicated man. He wasn't a complicated person. He wasn't a difficult person to understand. He wasn't a difficult, you know, some managers I've worked with over the years, you're like, what's he thinking? What's he doing? And what are we going to do tomorrow? And who's going to be playing this weekend? Never had that with Jack. None of us ever had that with Jack. You kind of only had to look at him to know he was either happy or he wasn't, or, you know, there was no mind games or hidden agendas with him. So I think Irish people relate to that. I think at that particular time, they'd had a good few years of missing out on the big tournaments, and they felt like someone needed to come along and mould what was potentially a very good group of players into a team that would win. And I think Jack would have always have done that, whatever job he'd have taken on. If he'd have took on a job in, you know, out of Mongolia, he would have very quickly took a group of players and given them a message about the way that he sees the game played and the way that it's got to be under him. Very few shaded areas with Big Jack. Everything was one way or the other, you know, and you very quickly understood that. So I believe the Irish people felt like they needed somebody like that to run the team, somebody to get them over the line. And obviously, with his pedigree as an international footballer, he'd been around football for an awful long time. He had a reputation of being no nonsense and very indignant and adamant about what he wanted. He had that reputation as he arrived. And I think they very quickly saw that.
One of the other themes the film picks up on it is this this idea that, you know, after decades of being presented as quite primitive, like his tactical style is actually shown in a way that it probably deserves, which is there are innovative parts of it. There are bits of it which are actually very contemporary if you look at the way that a lot of managers are playing today.
Correct.
But one of the things that fascinated me was this idea that he took players in 94 to a certain extent in 88. He took players from big English clubs like Liverpool or Everton, Spurs, you know, Villa, you know, you and Steve Staunton were at Villa in 94. And you're kind of, for want of a better expression, you're used to the ball. You're all used to being a little bit more proactive. How was it that he was able to take players who were used to that kind of superiority and say, we're going to play in, not in a submissive way, but in such a different way? So I'm thinking of someone like, for instance, John Aldridge. John Aldridge, you know, Real Sociedad, Liverpool, very successful at Oxford. And yet you've got someone, you're saying to someone like that, you're going to run channels for me. You're going to work harder. You're going to be less of a focal point and more of a kind of first line of defence. How was he able to do that successfully?
I think Jack didn't rule with, the only fear you had from playing with Jack Charlton wasn't really fear of him as an individual. It was the fear of not playing. And it would be quite simple, really. It would be if you don't do what I want you to do. And he'd sometimes sort of during training, his training was never sort of Rafa Benitez, like, you know, two inches there, stop, come towards me 6 inches, now you're in the perfect position. It wasn't like that. He'd kind of get hold of your hand, Jack, in training sometimes. He'd get hold of your hand and he'd walk you into a position. Not there, here. That's where I need you. This is where I need you at this point, ready to do this. But it was seemingly quite basic, but the message actually was, I remember on my debut, we played France at Daly Mount Park. And he walked up the back of the bus and I was sat looking out the window and he sat next to me. And Norwich at that time, we were playing some really attractive football. We had some very technically gifted players and a team had been sort of knitted together that was playing nice stuff. And he come up to the back of the bus, sat next to me without looking at me. He was sort of looking back down the bus. I've seen you a few times for Norwich, you know that. And yeah, I know you lot. If you tippy-tappy about with it in the middle of the park and lose it in there with me, you'll be on the next plane home.
Did you think he was trying to wind you up?
And actually, when he got up and walked away, I actually sort of had a little look over my shoulder to see if he was taking the mickey out of me as it was my debut or something, because I wouldn't have put that past him either, but he wasn't. The square ball in midfield was like, you know, Jack's... I think he used to wake up in the middle of the night. He must have, you know, having nightmares about that scenario, because he always felt if you play a square ball across your halfway line and it gets cut out, the best players in the world will be through you very, very quickly. Once they're behind your midfield and your back four is backpedaling towards their own 18-yard box, you're in trouble. You're going to concede goals more often than not. So that kind of ball was outlawed, really. If you gave a square ball to someone that was acceptable, and the guy miscontrolled it and it went under his foot, Jack wouldn't give him a rollicking. He'd give you a rollicking for giving him the ball in the first place. It was that kind of mentality, you know. So there were a few golden rules. We could do what we like at the top third of the field. He liked you being a little bit more creative and inventive, and he loved getting to the byline, very much like Pep Guardiola does. You think about Guardiola's fullbacks getting to that byline and cutting things back across the 6-yard line, like Klopp does with Trent and particularly Robertson, getting right to the top of the field. He loved that. He absolutely loved that. And of course, he was insistent on the press. And the press had to be relentless. It had to be committed. There was no half measures to it unless you were prepared to totally commit to that press for 90 minutes. He used to say, if anyone's knackered, put your hand up and we'll make a change. And I often used to... I used to say, Jack, what happens if 8 of us are knackered? You know, we may have a slight issue at some point if there's like, you turn around and there's 9 of us standing there like that, you know. And he had a great ability in, and the flexibility, you know, just genuinely wasn't there. There wasn't flexibility to kind of say, how about we do this and how about, no.
I was going to ask about that, actually. Just going to butt in here and say, there's a moment in the film where he's described as... learning a lot of what he knew from Don Revy, and you needed to pick what you wanted to do and then kind of doggedly stick to it forever. And it seems like there are moments in his story and in the film which maybe explore the downsides of that. I mean, we've heard a lot about the upsides, but what were the downsides, Andy?
Well, the downsides were when we went to America in 94, I mentioned in the film about he was reluctant to change. I said it's something that he wasn't particularly good at. I meant that in a complimentary way. The fact that this flexibility wasn't there meant that the message was loud and clear. Look, we look at Man United at the moment. We see a kind of confused sort of team, don't we? We don't really know. Are they a possession-based team? Are they a counter-attacking team? What are they really? We knew what we were. We knew how we had to be. There was no, we never, I never, ever, ever walked out into the field in a green shirt and thought, I wonder what we're going to do today. I wonder how this performance is going to go today. I kind of knew what we would do. It's just whether the opposition cope with it or whether they didn't really, you know. So I think with Jack, that message was always loud and clear. The downsides in 94 were, it was very hot, unbelievably hot. Our second game was in Florida, in Orlando, at 12 o'clock.
Mexico, Andy.
Yeah. 12 o'clock midday kickoff in Florida, you know, and it was 115 degrees in the stadium. And so the only alteration that we made at that time was the team had evolved a little bit from 90 to 94. We had an extra man in midfield. John Sheridan played with Roy Keane and myself. We had some more runners from midfield a little bit rather than two up front. And that obviously gives you a little bit more insurance at the back as well if teams are able to cope with your physical style a lot better. So, but they were only minor issues. But the downside for us was that he was reluctant to change. He wasn't comfortable with looking it wouldn't have been something on his agenda to, right, I'm going to, that worked well for 5 or 6 years. I'm going to change the style completely now. No chance, never, you know. So as you start to get older, that becomes a problem. And in the end, it did become a problem. When we played Holland in 96 in the playoff game, there was all the Kluiverts, the Seedorfs, all of those boys were now really flying and breaking through in the Dutch team. And there was still me and Paul and Aldo and Ray. And we were we couldn't provide the energy and didn't have the legs anymore to make that running game really work.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello, I'm Ian McIntosh, and despite literally spending months of my life playing Football Manager, I'm still terrible at it. That's why I'm launching the Football Manager Show, the latest podcast from The Athletic. Every week, I'll speak to the people who know the game best, the people who make the game. We'll take a proper look at things like training, recruitment, and tactics. We'll try to answer your questions. We'll do everything we can to keep you eager to play just one more game, and altogether less inclined to quit without saving. The era of Cherno and Tonton and dear sweet Michael Duff is over. The new Football Manager is bigger, better, more challenging than ever. And I need some help. If you do too, you can subscribe now. Just look for the Football Manager Show by The Athletic, wherever you get all your other podcasts. It starts in November, and knowing my track record, I'll be unemployed by December.
Where did the buy-in come from? Because I looking back now, look, the game has changed. It's, you know, it's been, you know, nearly three decades. And I always think of an Arsene Wenger quote when he talks about dealing with footballers. And he says it's because footballers have got richer and they've become almost more powerful than the managers. He said that coaching is kind of like persuasion. And one of the things that you say to camera, Joe touched on this, you know, when you were captain, if you knocked on his hotel room door and said, Gaffer, you know, he's not going to be interested. One of the things that also comes across is this idea, like players obviously really wanted to play for him. They wanted to follow him. There are some really, I don't want to step on the film's toes and ruin some of the scenes, but there are some really touching moments, particularly after the Italy defeat in 90.
Mm.
Where did that affection come from? Because it seems to me like that kind of thing is lost to the game. It's not accessible. You couldn't have the authoritarian approach and the affection at the same time anymore.
Very good question. It's a good point. I think that Jack had an incredible personality. He had, I've often said he could be all things in one day, you know, like a spring day, you know, you can wake up to sun and have a thunderstorm and then ridiculous wind and then, you know, more rain. That was kind of, Jack was like that. He could be absolutely fine in the morning. Then all of a sudden you have a face like thunder, something's flip the switch. And then he had the hump for a couple of hours, and then gradually in the evening he might sort of come round again. You know, he was a bit like that. So, but in amongst it all, he had a brilliant sense of humor. And he was, you know, he come up the back of the bus and he'd have a game of cards on the way to a game with the lads, you know.
Yeah.
Let me say this, because he was thrifty, Big Jack, right? Yeah. If that's a polite way of saying it, you know, if you were playing cards for a few quid and you happen to pinch a few quid off him, I mean, you know, I've heard him say, "You're not coming next month. I ain't picking you. You know, if you lay that card on me and don't put it on him, you're not coming next trip." You know, and he used to like, but he had a great sense of humour. He did. He used to be great fun in that manner. So I think that we took on board his perceived, if you like, tactical sort of deficiencies. You know, we sort of took that on board. We took that on board that other teams were doing things differently, and should we be doing that? Actually, we took that all on board. And when you put it all into the pot with Jack, you got a very likable man. You got a World Cup winner. You got someone that, if you don't do it his way, he just won't play you. He just won't pick you, you know, and he won't sort of cajole you into coming around to his way of thinking. It's like, no, you don't play. He's got your shirt. Unlucky. So I think that when you put the mix in, I think it comes out with players wanting to and respecting that it had to be done his way. And because of the likability of him, players being prepared to give it absolute everything.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm 36 now, and whilst I remember fragments of Italia 90, I think the first World Cup game that I became properly invested in was your win over Italy at Giant Stadium.
Yeah.
Can you take us inside the dressing room? For younger people, look up that Italian team, because that is at the time, it's kind of a galaxy of stars you were playing.
Yeah.
An amazingly gifted football team.
They were.
What did he tell you before? And I mean, you're in there, you're in the dressing room. I think it's true that you actually changed your kit before kickoff. Is that true? Or is that an urban myth that you had to change your kit?
100% true. So you get to a stadium. There was a couple of funny stories on the day actually with that, because, we were about half an hour from Giant Stadium. We were staying in a hotel. When we got up on the morning of the game, I don't know who it was. I can't remember who it was, but one of the support team around, one of the staff said, they think that the Italians have got most of the tickets in Giant Stadium and that we might only have 20, 30% of the tickets to Irish fans. Well, whatever. Okay, you know. So as we're driving in towards Giant Stadium, we're going, and there's just, when I say coach loads, I mean like ridiculous amount and coach loads of Irish fans hanging out of the windows, scarves everywhere, going mad when they saw our bus. When we got to the stadium itself, we started to look around and we all started to say, maybe it's going to be 50-50. Maybe we'll have as many as them. By the time we went out for the warm-up, when we actually walked out, I was like literally, you know, it didn't surprise me because I know what Irish fans are like. It was totally, the ground was, there was 92,000 there on the day. There must have been 80,000 Irish. There must have been, all decked out in their colours. And it was funny because as we walked out on the pitch for the warm-up, Jack came out as well and he turned to Tony Cascarino and he said, "Cass, you're the only Italian in here," right? which was a great line, you know, and again, made everybody laugh. But no, so for an hour and a half, you're in the stadium before the game. And we'd already done all our homework on Italy. We'd already done everything about them. And Arrigo Sacchi was kind of this, he was this emerging manager now, tactically very, very, well, not emerging. He'd already been a successful manager, yeah. But he was tactically, you know, at the top of his game and was the man to beat in that respect. And as you meant quite rightly say, Baggio, Dino Baggio, Maldini, you know, Baresi,
Conte was a substitute, I think.
Conte was a sub. He was. Antonio Conte was a sub. And
Paul Yuka was probably one of the best goalkeepers in the world at that time, I'd say. Yeah.
Beppe Signori, you know, players like that.
Yeah.
You know, they had an awful lot of very, very good players. So, so we'd already kind of gone through about what we're going to do and how we were going to do it. And again, it always come down to the same. Jack said, can we inflict upon them? Can they handle what we do? And he would always say, I don't think they can. I'm telling you now, Baresi is brilliant and he's a great organiser and he loves to organise that back four. And Maldini likes to have a touch and he'll have another touch and he'll have another touch. If we get on top of these people, I'm telling you now, they'll make mistakes. He said, and I want you swarming all over them from minute one.
It must be very empowering as a player to hear that from your coach, right?
It is. Because again, we'd had, prior to America, we'd been to Germany and won in a friendly. We'd been to Holland and won in a friendly when they had top teams with their top players. We my first 50 caps for Ireland, I lost four games, I think, or five matches. You know, we didn't get beat much. We didn't always win and we weren't prolific goal scorers, but we didn't lose too often. And we'd become accustomed to making life very difficult for teams we played against. And we were very, very good at that, very good at it. And so, it was empowering. It really was. But until we got in the tunnel, just before walking out from the game, when I'm standing at the front of the queue and Baresi's next to me and he's in white, blue, white, and I'm in white, green, white. So he looks at me and he gives me the finger like that as he's looking at my kit. And Packy Bonner's behind me. And I said, are we in the wrong kit here? We're not in the wrong kit, are we? We are literally just waiting for the referees to take us out onto the field. You know, all the television channels around the world are all tuning in on this game for this moment. You know, we are standing here in the wrong kit. Charlie, our little kit man, who's in the film, little Charlie.
Yeah,
amazing character, amazing guy. Jack was standing at the back of the queue. And I turned around and I said, we're in the wrong kit. And someone said, Charlie, we've got the wrong kit on. And little Charlie went, no, we haven't. And Jack screamed, Charlie, if we've got the wrong kit on, he said, you can imagine what he said. Sure enough, we should be in green, white, green. We've got the wrong kit on. Straight back in the dressing room, absolute carnage, everyone ripping everything off. And, you know, about 6 minutes later, we're back out there. All the television companies across the world with their ad breaks are going ballistic. And, we're late taking to the field, but there you go. It wasn't a deliberate kind of, way of delaying anything or stalling or knocking them out of their stride. Far from it. We had the wrong bloody kit on.
So if we've got any younger people that are listening who have never seen that game in its entirety, then you can still find it on YouTube. Watch it. Watch the whole performance, but also watch Paul McGrath playing that game. Because it's... If you know about Paul McGrath, you know about his difficulties in life, but also with injury, and you watch his performance against some of the very best Italian forwards of their generation, it's a remarkable thing. And actually, I think hearing Paul McGrath speak about Jack during the film is very touching. And by the end of it, I mean, in the past, he's referenced him as a father figure, as someone that was, you know, understandably a figure of great guidance. When you heard that... you'd known that Jack was unwell. When you heard that he had died, how did you feel?
Well, I knew that he wasn't well. We were already making the film. So for 18 months, we'd been doing some work with Jack and the family. I went up and met, I introduced Gabriel and Pete Thomas to Jack and his son, John, initially. And I could tell my own father recently passed away with dementia. So I was well versed on it, and I knew when I saw Jack that he wasn't in the best of health, and that he was sadly in decline. Because he was such a giant personality, and he was genuinely a big, big man, and because he was, there was never let me have a think about that with Jack. You know, because he always, if anyone asked him a question, no or yes or what, you know, there was never any messing around with him. So he had that personality of being kind of quite giant-like in his whole way. You know, he really was a big man with a big personality. So when you see someone in their you know, when they're about 83, 84 and they're starting to suffer with what is an awfully debilitating illness. It really did sort of hit home to me how cruel it is, how it can rob you of all of your characteristics and all of your traits that make you the person and the individual you are. It strips them all away from you. And it was quite sad to see him like that. He didn't really remember who I was at that time. His son John would keep reminding him. But one person he always did remember was Big Paul.
I wanted to pick up on that point as well, because it is exceptionally moving in the film. And there's a moment where Paul McGraw, speaking back on it now, describes that relationship as defining his life. And it struck me at that point, you know, watching that as viewers and as supporters of football, we probably rarely think about the delicacies of some of those relationships. But when he describes it like that, it makes a lot of sense. And it's quite an exceptional thought. So I just wanted to ask you about it because it must have been a special relationship.
He had loyalty was one of the words on Jack's notes. You'll have seen one note with loyalty on there. That was something that meant a lot to him. He entrusted players with playing a certain way. And those that gave him everything, those that did loyally try to back his way of doing things, he would absolutely reciprocate that loyalty back. So I think with Big Paul, I think Jack recognised that Paul had, this wasn't with Paul, this wasn't just somebody that had a party lifestyle and just wanted to go out and have a drink and just couldn't conform to rules. You know, it was much more serious than that for Paul. It was a genuine problem that he had, and I think Jack related to it very well, and again would loyally stand by Paul and try, and not only for the benefit of him and the team, get him out there playing, but I think also he was very aware of he mentions in the film about Paul understanding that when he leaves football, a lot of these people that are there for him today will not be there for him. And he generally had concerns about that. And so without doubt, Jack recognised that Paul could have problems at some point down the line, and wanted to do kind of everything that he could to possibly prepare him for that and help him for that.
Andy, just one more question from me. What's the memory that you treasure most of Jack? The man. I mean, he doesn't have to be football related.
No. Gosh. I mean, that's a tough question. He was such a... My biggest thing with Jack was that in order to thrive at anything, you have to enjoy what you're doing. There's got to be a love for it. There's got to be a want to do it. There's got to be a commitment from you to do it, but there's got to be an enjoyment around it. There's got to be something around it that makes it just that little bit different and that little bit special. And Jack had a fantastic ability to create an environment that you could go and tick all of those boxes. You could tick the lot with the Irish team at that time. He made you want. I didn't have to run through brick walls for Jack Charlton. I wanted to. He didn't make me. I wanted to do it for him, you know, and so did the other guys. And he had a fantastic natural ability to relate to people, which, again, is very evident in the film, across all strands and all walks of life. He had a great ability to connect. And my biggest sort of thing with Jack was his love and his laughter, really, for the group of lads that he had, the fun we shared together. I probably wouldn't have one actual moment where I thought, you know, that was the one moment where I saw everything. You know, I don't think that would be the case. I think he was so funny. He wasn't complex. He wasn't complicated. But he was what you see is what you get. And if you stepped across the line, you'd know about it pretty quickly. But I just think I think he was everything. If I was going to be a football manager, if I was likening him to anybody today, Klopp's got those same sort of things to me with his group of players, more than any other more than any other manager in the Premier League. Even if you're not playing under Jurgen Klopp, I bet you like him. I bet you like him. You know, and Jack, that was the same with Jack. Not everybody loved him. I did, and most of the guys did. Not everyone would have done, but I think everyone would have liked him. I think they would have done.
Oh, thanks, Andy. It's been an absolute privilege, this. And it's the film is just terrific. So please brilliant. Do pass on our regards.
I most certainly will, and I really appreciate your time, guys. Lovely to talk to you.